You're listening to highlights from the One Planet podcast interview with Audrea Lynn, journalist, musician, and writer of the book Free the Land. This program is brought to you by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
I think it's been a very long journey for me to come to this topic and to the ideas I discuss in the book. And it actually probably started over 10 years ago, when at the time I was a journalist and I was reporting on the climate crisis and the social movements that were coalescing around it. The anti-gentrification movement was really popping off. The loudest part of that narrative was that gentrification is basically white people moving into poor neighborhoods of colors and bringing in their matcha oat milk latte cafes and their pretentious $25 cocktails. But really, as I went to protests and I started listening to housing activists and people that were involved in the struggle, what I was repeatedly hearing was a slightly different, more complex story, which is that gentrification was about longtime residents of a neighborhood being evicted or priced out of their apartments, which is a process they had no control over if they're tenants. And so basically, these communities had no control over the lands they had lived on for decades or sometimes longer. I started working on this book during the first Trump administration, when there were moments when it felt kind of similar, honestly. And at the time, I feel like people were asking me a lot, how do you actually report on the climate movement and maintain your sanity and not just like spiral into a deep, deep depression? And what I realized was that the kind of reporting that I do mostly consists of going around and talking to activists and community groups about the work that they're doing. I'm interested in not just the very big problems we face as a society, an economy, a political system, but also how people are trying to think through solutions or approaches to it. So in the last few years, there's been a very big boom in community land trusts, which is a model where a community buys up or owns a large swath of land. They basically hold it in trust. So it's community owned and community controlled. But the things on top of it, homes or farms or businesses, can be privately owned. So individuals can still earn equity or have a place to call their own. This has become popular in the housing movement, but it was pioneered in the U.S. by civil rights activists in the late 60s and the 70s. I bring up this example and community land trusts to say that I spend a lot of time around people who are thinking through these solutions and trying these new models and tweaking existing models and coming up with new ways to give their communities a leg up. Because they've been dealing with our existing capitalist system for so long, I think they understand the root of the problem. And so the solutions they're coming up with address these things. They're more sustainable. They're more democratic and equitable. They give more control to people in the community. There's a lot of public land in the US and Canada, but you know, it's obviously connected to this question of who belongs to the public. So the statistic that you quoted for land ownership, where like 90% of private rural farmlands are white owned. At the beginning of America, the only citizens, the only people who could buy property and own property were white men. And Black people could not own land or even own their own selves and own property as a free self until the mid-late 19th century. So that's part of why we have these very drastic, almost unthinkable inequalities in who has access to private land. But this passage that I've chosen, it also points to how, when it comes to public lands, there's so many things that we can do with land and how a government decides that they're going to manage or use lands that they own and control. It has everything to do with who they think they're doing it for and who they believe deserves to use it and decide how it's used and enjoy it and benefit from it. Historically, that has not been Indigenous people or Black people or people of color in America. Not all properties owned and managed by government are intended for public use. Military bases, for one, are tightly guarded, for instance. But national parks are potent reminders that our nations are tied to our lands, and our governments steward them for the people. In democratic nations, these governments are also accountable to the people, distinguishing them from conservation land trusts or any private landowner. We, the people, have some control over how we use and benefit from public lands. In fact, national parks make up only 3% of Canada's landmass and 4% of America's, but their symbolic value far exceeds their acreages. Once, out of curiosity, I asked my Malaysian dad how a poor immigrant from the Asian tropics got into hiking and downhill skiing. "These are very Western things," he chuckled. "Only people with money can do them." I shrank a little, suddenly aware of how my own relationship to these places say far more about my place in the world than it does about the land. When I first started writing this book, it was a book that really foregrounded the problems with our entire land ownership system that treats land as a commodity. And I think the way that we talk about land or any of these issues, racial justice, inequality, food justice, housing, reflects this. We tend to talk about the problems with it. And when we sort of diagnose the problem, there's these big concepts that we attach to it, like racial justice. It's like, what does that mean? Or environmental justice. You know, I'll throw out that word. Sometimes people be like, "What? But what does that mean?" First of all, it's just easier for readers and for myself to connect with an idea or what's happening in the world through stories of people who are actually dealing with these issues. So like community groups who have been fighting housing injustice or environmental justice for a long time. But the bigger thing actually is that I realize that I spend so much time reading about problems and I feel hopeless about all the stuff that I've read when it feels like there's no alternative vision for us to be working toward. But I think even the fact that there are a lot of alternative ideas and a lot of people who are working really hard and devoting their lives and energy to finding them and working with them, that has not only given me a lot of hope personally, but it's proof to me that there are actually probably a lot of other alternative futures for us. There's so many different paths that we could go, and it's a political choice to not explore any of them. And when it comes to some of the Indigenous folks who I talked to in the book, who spend a lot of time working on like managing forests in the Pacific Northwest, or who farm in the high deserts of New Mexico, their families and their ancestors have been working or living with the land for generations, sometimes generations spanning centuries. And there's just so much knowledge that gets built up. If I spend one season gardening in a backyard, I learn so much about the environment of my backyard. If a farmer spends one entire season working the land, just think about the amount of knowledge and skill they develop in that period of time. And then imagine that centuries, millennium, and it's an entire community who's worked with the land that's changed, that's gone through different phases of abundance and the being fallow. And that's so much knowledge that gets lost. I don't think there's no place for the more white scientific approach to land. There's a lot of value in these ideas and methods as well. But our society and our economy has just placed an overwhelming emphasis on them and completely, not just ignored, but sometimes destroyed and decimated these other forms of knowledge that are actually much more tied to our local environments in the U.S. And so we just lose so much knowledge and skill and just understanding of all the different ways that we can live with and on the land, ways that are very important and increasingly more relevant. I think for me, making music engages a different part of my brain or body than writing and thinking about ideas. It helps me to tap into a different kind of creative force. When I was writing this book, I fell away from music a little bit, but I started surfing a lot, which took the place of it. I needed to have some other thing I did while I was writing that was not writing and not thinking. Surfing worked really well with helping me to finish this book, is that like it forces you to disengage with yourself. You have to be in tune with nature and the ocean. You have to just work with whatever waves are coming your way. It's hard for me to sometimes pinpoint what about my identity shapes how I think, because I just live in this identity. I don't know what it would be like to think a different way from how I think. But I do feel like there have been a lot of periods of my life where I felt like an outsider looking in. That's really made me very, very aware of how precarious everything is, for better and for worse. There's always, in work or in life, times where things can feel really daunting and it feels impossible, like you're in an impossible situation. And sometimes you just have to ride it out. And so it's okay to feel bad and depressed about the state of the world or the state of your life. It's good to acknowledge those feelings, in fact. But at the same time, sometimes you just gotta keep going.
We hope you've enjoyed this program and listening to the highlights of this podcast. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast or learn more about environmental projects, click on the subscribe button. Thank you for listening.